From CPRI and the CPRI Knowledge Hub, this is Research Minutes, a weekly look at new and important research in education. Today we explore growth mindset, the belief that academic ability is not fixed and can be strengthened over time. In the largest ever study of its kind, dozens of researchers set out to learn if a short, online intervention could foster a growth mindset in students, and what impact that could have on academic achievement.
So then students go on to learn real neuroscientific evidence about the brain and how the brain forms new connections when it learns. And finally, students are asked to reflect on that information by writing a persuasive letter to a future student who might be coming to their school, in which the research participants say, if you're feeling down and feeling like you're dumb because school is hard, keep in mind that the brain can grow and learn and be developed like a muscle. Struggle doesn't mean you're dumb.
We welcome lead author and University of Texas at Austin researcher David Yeager, who discusses the study's findings and some key takeaways for educators and researchers across the country.
I think the first takeaway is that we now have a treatment that could be used universally for ninth graders in public schools in the US, and it's available for free. However, we know that this result is just the beginning.
That's right now on Research Minutes.
Hello and welcome to Research Minutes. I'm Keith Heumeller. Today, I'm happy to be speaking with David Yeager, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Texas at Austin and lead author of the newly published National Study of Learning Mindsets. Thanks for joining us, David.
Thanks for having me.
So your study, recently published in the journal Nature, focuses on growth mindset approaches in general and of the effectiveness of one specific growth mindset intervention in particular. And to call this study big would be a bit of an understatement. It is, in fact, the largest study of its kind ever conducted and was carried out by a multidisciplinary team of roughly 24 researchers, including UC Davis's Paul Hanselman, Stanford's Gregory Walton, UT Austin's Jared Murray, and even Stanford's Carol Dweck, who pioneered growth mindset research back in the 90s. To start, could you just give us a little bit of background? What is growth mindset as we know it today, and what led you to conduct this study?
Yeah. So a growth mindset is the belief that people's abilities in school can grow and be developed with the right support, whether that's effort or changing your learning strategies or seeking out appropriate help. And it's designed to contradict what's called a fixed mindset, which is the idea that abilities are fixed. They can't be changed no matter what you do. And a lot of basic laboratory research had found that a fixed mindset could stand in the way in the motivation to learn when students confront challenges. So a student who felt like smartness is fixed and it can never change, but then went on to struggle in their math class and not be able to solve a problem, might wonder if maybe that difficulty is a sign that they're not smart enough and that things can't improve. So the growth mindset research started as a very basic psychological phenomenon to try to understand the origins of phenomena like learned helplessness or loss of motivation. But at some point, Carol and others learned that it might be possible to teach students a growth mindset and change their motivation to learn. And that has spawned a great interest in trying to craft interventions that test a kind of striking possibility. The idea that just changing a belief about people's abilities might have some measurable effect on the grades or achievement that students ultimately show over time.
What was the impetus for a study of this size? Were there specific knowledge gaps that you were hoping to fill or specific questions you were trying to answer?
So growth mindset research was moving along like much other psychological research for a while. But then we started realizing that these interventions that have the potential to be useful in schools weren't tested in large enough samples to really justify large-scale use. And so around 2010, a team of us, all graduate students at Stanford working with Carol Dweck, started taking intensive in-person growth mindset interventions and seeing if we could reduce them to their essence, make them far shorter, maybe 25 minutes or 50 minutes, and then test them over the internet. What amazed us at the time was that even a short exposure to a growth mindset message over the internet could improve grades, especially for low achieving students. And despite the excitement for the randomized trials evaluating a growth mindset, there was still a huge question unanswered, which is, why was this possible? And where would this work? Surely a growth mindset treatment can improve grades everywhere because it doesn't teach students any content. It can't possibly overcome all limitations to motivation that students face. So we wanted to know, where does the growth mindset not work? And where it does work, why is it the case that it works? And to do that, we thought we needed a nationally representative sample that has the full variety and heterogeneity of students, the full variety and heterogeneity of schools. And if you test the same treatment in all of those very different schools, you might then learn where it works, where it doesn't, and why it works. And that's why we needed this paper that we published in Nature.
So in addition to answering some of those specific questions that you just mentioned, there's also a component built into the study to facilitate future research in the realm of growth mindset.
Yeah, we realized pretty early on that if you run a large-scale RCT in a nationally representative sample, you're not just testing one hypothesis. You're actually creating a data set that can be useful for the field in general for a few reasons. One is that there's never been a nationally representative randomized trial evaluating an adolescent educational intervention in the US. And so people who have no interest in growth mindset at all, but want to learn about the best ways to do educational experiments can then use our data set and move on from there. But the second thing is that there are so many more additional things to learn about growth mindset that go beyond what we learned in the first paper. The first paper only focuses on what effects differ between schools, but we also can learn about teacher practices. Who are the teachers who best enhance growth mindset intervention? And what are they doing? What are they saying? And so we hope that this data set can become a resource for the field among educational researchers in general, and really anyone who is interested in the intersection between what teachers do and how students respond and how to motivate students to do well in school.
I think a lot of us would be curious as to how a study this large is designed and carried out. Could you give us maybe an overview of the scope and the methods you use to try and answer all these questions?
So to develop the treatment materials, we started with the challenge of how can you convey a growth mindset in a compelling and efficient way so that it's equally compelling across pools of participants and across schools across the country? And so we borrowed a lot of insights from the growing field of design thinking and A/B testing and carried out a series of randomized experiments and focus groups and interviews over about a year and a half, to take early stage growth mindset interventions and prepare them to scale up. And we published a paper on that in 2016, where it describes our piloting process. Once we had a treatment that we thought would apply broadly across America, we then had the challenge of randomly sampling schools so that we could truly generalize to the schools across America. And it turns out the standard way of drawing a random sample isn't really suitable for an experimental study looking at moderators or sources of heterogeneity of treatment effects. That is, people often say, we want big schools or small schools. We want schools in the Southwest and the Northeast. We want schools that are rural or urban. But if you don't have a theory that growth mindset means something different in the Northeast versus the Southwest, why is that your stratifying characteristic? We wondered. And so what we did instead was to say, we think a growth mindset might interact with the resources and advantages in a school. We think it might be unnecessary in the most advantaged schools. We think it might not be able to compensate for disadvantage in the least advantaged schools. But in the medium advantaged schools, then that's where it might be a sweet spot, where it might work the best. And so we also knew that school achievement level is confounded with socioeconomic factors and race ethnicity factors in the US. there's massive segregation with respect to both of those characteristics. And so any study looking at school achievement levels would have to take into account the racial and ethnic composition at a minimum. And so we worked with a team of statisticians, including Beth Tipton, who's now at Columbia, to craft the first ever sampling plan for a representative sample that incorporated information about moderators, specifically school achievement level, and confounds of those moderators in drawing our random sample of schools. And we're really excited about what the study has to say about including voices in educational research that are very often excluded from educational research.
So in the end, what was the scope of the study? How many students and schools ended up being included in your sample?
We randomly selected 65 public high schools from across the country. About 40% of them were rural schools, which are very often excluded from educational research. Those 65 schools included around 12,500 students. And those students were then assigned to a treatment or a control group on the computer. And then students completed a computerized intervention that took about an hour over the course of two different class periods, usually a few weeks apart. And then from students' perspectives, the study was over. We don't talk to them again. We just get their grades at the end of the school year. And we compare the outcomes for students who got the treatment versus students who got the control.
And what did this intervention actually look like from the students' perspective?
Sure. So from students' perspectives, the intervention is not telling them to have a growth mindset. Instead, what it is, an invitation to consider a new belief system that can help them deal with the transition to high school. We say high school is hard. The challenges are rising. You don't always feel a lot of support, but knowing that the brain can be developed and grow like a muscle is one way to stay optimistic and hopeful, even during the really challenging first few months or even years of high school. So then students go on to learn real neuroscientific evidence about the brain and how the brain forms new connections when it learns. And finally, students are asked to reflect on that information by writing a persuasive letter to a future student who might be coming to their school, in which the research participants say to that hypothetical future student, if you're feeling down and feeling like you're dumb because school's hard, keep in mind that the brain can grow and learn and be developed like a muscle. And so struggle doesn't mean you're dumb. And students type that out. They complete it, as I said, in around 25 minutes. And then from their perspective, it's over. To them, it looks and feels like a survey about starting high school. It's not designed as a treatment to tell them what to think.
So let's jump into the results. Did the program change how students viewed themselves or their intellectual abilities? And if so, did that impact their behavior or their academic performance in any way?
Yeah, so the first thing is that the program changed students' mindsets overall. We think quite substantially and quite impressively given the messiness of school settings. Then what we found is that students' grades overall were improved, especially when you look at preventing students from having a failing or poor performance indicator. So the treatment reduced the rates at which students earned a D or F average in their core classes in ninth grade by 3 percentage points overall. Of course, that 3 percentage point effect overall is concentrated in the subgroup of students who were already at risk of having low grades. Students who were going to get A's no matter what, of course, would have a hard time benefiting from the treatment. And what we find is that a 3 percentage point effect overall that generalizes to 3 million students per year in high school would be one of the most cost-effective approaches for preventing failure in ninth grade that have ever been discovered at any cost. And the fact that the treatment is short and very low cost makes it really exciting as a potential way to start the year off right, especially for at-risk students.
So what do you think are the takeaways here? It seems this kind of work could have implications for everything from classroom practice and school leadership to district level or even higher level policy discussion.
I think the first takeaway is that we now have a treatment that could be used universally for ninth graders in public schools in the US. And it's available for free at www.perts, PERTS.net. We're never going to charge for the program, and none of us own growth mindset programs or businesses. And we just want a research validated tool to be used by as many students as possible. However, we know that this result is just the beginning. And the reason we know that is that schools that were poised to benefit the most were schools that had a climate and culture that supported growth, learning, and curiosity. And so a short one-time online intervention does not let school leaders off the hook. We still have to create the kinds of school environments that would allow the seed of a growth mindset to grow and flourish in our schools.
But it certainly, at least under some conditions, does suggest some positive impacts of fostering growth mindset in students.
I think the study validates the field's interest in growth mindset as a concept. We did everything we could to tie our hands and do a scientific test where bias was removed as much as we know how to do or anyone in science knows how to do. At the same time, this study, which ends the question of whether the growth mindset can matter, really begins a new and more important era of work, which is how to make it matter reliably in our diverse schools across the US. And we and the rest of the field are just at the beginning of that learning journey of how to make growth mindset come to fruition more reliably.
And that brings me to my last question. As you mentioned before, a big component of the study was laying the groundwork for future research. I'd be curious to know where you think the study of growth mindset goes from here.
The next paper that will come out of these data will focus on math teacher practices. We find that math teachers with more of a growth mindset tend to enhance treatment effects even more. And we want to know, what are those practices that they're using day to day, moment to moment, that allow a growth mindset intervention to have enhanced effects? And then we want to know, how can we train those teachers? How can we change practice? And so we think a new era of studies that simultaneously improve the school culture and climate and kind of prepare students to have the mindset where they benefit from learning opportunities could be really transformative. And we hope that lots of other scholars are interested in joining us in asking and answering those types of research questions.
Well, it certainly is a remarkable study, and I encourage our listeners to go and read the full article titled "A National Experiment Reveals Where a Growth Mindset Improves Achievement" in the journal Nature. And you can also access a wealth of additional resources and information on this line of research by visiting mindsetscholarsnetwork.org. David Yeager, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this week's Research Minutes, presented by the CPRE Knowledge Hub. For more episodes of this podcast, or to subscribe to the series, visit us at cprehub.org. That's cprehub.org. To share thoughts on today's episode, or to suggest future topics, follow us on Twitter at cprehub.org.